CliffCentral.com.
It reminds me of my role.
I'm the backup singer, remember?
Our days in the streets, Zabalazing.
What days did you have on the streets? San Bernard Noke, welcome to the show. It's Frankly Speaking. 1 hour of hardcore debates here in studio. We are going to be talking about all cool things that are going on in our country that we need to speak about. And this one is specific. Like this one, we really need to speak about. Change the conversation slightly. You see how I just get into it because I'm very excited about this.
That's good.
How you doing?
I've never seen a white guy so excited to speak about land. It's encouraging.
Why are you doing that now?
It's encouraging.
We're talking about land. And listen, before we get going here, I just want to thank all the listeners over the last few shows. We've had quite a bit of interaction on our Facebook pages as well as Twitter and I was going to say Instagram, but that's a lie. But Twitter and then Facebook specifically. So if you haven't checked us out, go to Frankly Speaking. You can check out all the old shows. You can check out what people are saying about some of the old shows as well. These comments are really, really interesting. And I think this is what we're trying to do here. Create a public discourse for conversations that need to be had in South Africa. And hopefully share your thoughts as well. Today we're talking about land. We're doing something slightly different though. Because we've done land. Land has been on everyone's lips for a long time. It came up again in the NEC meeting, Zuma clarifying what he meant, talking about the Mangaung 2012 discussion. So lots of thoughts about land at the moment, seeming that the ANC want to radicalize, the word has come up, radicalize this land expropriation from willing buyer to willing seller to something different, where we don't pay, we don't recompensate. And we wanted to talk about this openly and say, maybe what is another way to look at this? How should we look at this? What's a different way? We've got some really great guests in studio. Nomani Sorgasa, she joins us. Fantastic person to have. Not only is she bloody brilliant, but she's been working on this issue specifically for a long, long time. And I think she's so gutful that she also wants to change the discussion point. So we'll be speaking to her as well as you at home. If you want to get in on this conversation, you can hook us up on Twitter at Rory Shabalala or at Yebo_Levy. I've been speaking. Rory, now you speak. What do you want to say?
I'm not feeling well, and I think I should let everyone know because they're going to be asking why I sound so down. It's not the land issue. The prospect of getting land does not depress me. I'm just not feeling well. I must say, Nomani Sorgasa is public enemy number one for the land, the Minister of Land and Rural Development. I once attended a conference on the Land Act at UCT at some stage, and I remember her going wild and just poking at him, and he was just, you could see that this man is not comfortable. Yes, and Quinty. So she is quite an animated person. It was quite interesting to watch, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun. And it's a serious conversation, but I think the big thing here is we have to start building a country. We have to start moving forward as a country, and it feels like with this particular land thing we've reached deadlock for a number of different reasons, and the question is, why have we reached deadlock? One argument says we've got all of the laws that are required to expedite this situation and get it over and done with. Others are saying no, but why should we be paying for it? And this is all of a sudden then introducing a bit of maybe complexity to the situation. Some are saying, do black people want land at all? So it looks like we've reached deadlock. We had a restitution process that was supposed to be taking place. It seems to have also ground down to a halt as well. So there's a big question now: is how do we unlock this situation? How do we get to a point where we're done, so we can actually begin to move on? And is the land issue an economic issue, or is it an emotional issue? Is it just an issue of historical redress? So there's a lot to be spoken about here, and I have a feeling that by the time we reach the end of the show, we're going to be saying we need need to have another show. I'm just.
Why are you doing that? We haven't even started yet. Moniso, I want to say good morning to you. We do have some people online, so we're going to speak to them as well. But let's speak to you first and say hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Just looking very fashionable with your late summer fashion with glasses
and you know, you are
Miss Fashion, hey?
Well, if I'm going to talk about land, I feel good.
So I think, you know, to start this conversation, and we're going to bring in someone named Annalise as well to discuss some things here as well. But to start this conversation, let's understand where we are. I mean, why, you know, 23 years later, are we still so baffled by this land question and perplexed and so many fingers to point? And what's going on? Give us some context.
Well, I mean, I think that there's actually, you know, one has to acknowledge the fact that there's quite a lot that the Department of Rural Development has done. Land is an incredibly complex issue, not just for South Africa, but for the whole world in different ways. And there are different components, of course, to the, how the Constitution looks at land in Section 25.
Yes.
So there's the issue around restitution for, you know, for people who were forcibly removed and who lost land, after 1913.
Give us an example. I think examples on
important here. For example,
the District 6 kind of movements.
District 6, but also, a lot of people, you know, there was a time when, there was this need to create black, to move black spots, as it were, in white areas. Mm. So there were forced removals way after District 6 even, and the creation of homelands. So you have people who lost homes, you have people who lost, ancestral graves and all that. So there's the Restitution Act that is supposed to deal with that.
Right.
Now, the problem with the Restitution Act is that it's very slow. There are people, and sometimes both people on both sides, the people that the claimants and the people from whom the claim is being addressed, that is the farmer who's in that particular land. So you find that it's very, very slow. I mean, there are backlogs that go to almost 19 years, right? So there is a problem there. The second problem with restitution is that because some of the people who lost their land have moved into other areas, it's been very difficult for them to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, let's be frank about this. Farming is not easy, you know. So some people have opted for money. I think not because they wouldn't have wanted to farm, but because they considered this. I mean, I look at people in the village where I come from, right? We grew up working the land, right? So it's not romantic. So if you're not sure that you're going to have the capacity, the support, the government support, and you know, and all of that, you're likely to take money, right? So some people have taken money, The other aspect of land is, of course, security of tenure, which addresses those people whose tenure is not safe. That is, people who live in farms and people who live in communal areas, that is, the so-called former homelands in rural areas. So there's a very slow process there in terms of conversion of those rights into secure customary rights, and also having a conversation about whether people should have title deeds or whether it should be communal title deeds, what kind of tenure reform regime should exist there. The third one, of course, which is very tricky, is the one that gets everybody's backs up, is the one on redistribution. And redistribution has been basically, firstly, the Constitution doesn't say that it's willing buyer, willing seller. But the ANC initial policy translated it as such. And then it proved to be very expensive. And so there's been a slowing, in terms of that as well. The other aspect around redistribution is that there's also a lot of populism around it. There is nothing in the Constitution as it is that actually prevents redistribution. Right. The Constitution, it's important to be clear on this. Section 25, which is the property clause under which land falls, doesn't give anybody, doesn't give you, Andrew, or me, the right to property. Right. But what it does, it says you cannot be arbitrarily deprived of property. So these are the three elements that are very very difficult, and I think where we have gotten stuck is that firstly, restitution has been very slow. Thirdly, the you know, land and agriculture tend to be seen interchangeably, and so there's emphasis, for example, on is this land being used highly, you know, for high production. And I don't think that's the only conversation that you can have. Yes. Land is not just about the economics. Land is about history. It's about identity. And I think that we are at a stage in South Africa where we need to keep some cool heads and actually revisit what we understand by land. And that is my my conversation at the moment.
All right, I'm going to bring Annelise in here now because I think it's very important to have her into this conversation. We're speaking about, frankly speaking, how do we unlock the land gridlock in SA? Nombonizo Gasa is our guest in studio. Annelise Crosby, she's head of legal policy of Agricultural Industry Association. Jeez, look at my Agri SA. Annelise, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you.
I think one of the issues around this whole land discussion is, do we actually know what the statistics of the land distribution is? I mean, how much is government owned, how much is white owned, how much is black owned?
Yes, that's a very good question. And I think there were some very valid comments made by the previous speaker as well, because this is indeed an incredibly complex issue. It's also a very emotive issue. And one understands the emotion. It was possible to stand back.
Annelise, we're going to try you again. Let's hold that discussion. We just want to get a better line for you. Nomaniso, I think maybe coming back to you around that question, you know, like doing the research on this this whole thing, the idea of who owns what is somewhat in the dark at the moment. I mean, there's some statistics, but it doesn't feel concrete at the moment for me.
Well, firstly, I think it's important to, you know, people continue to talk about a 13%, you know, of the population occupying 87%.
Yes.
That is not true. It's
right.
Changed. But it hasn't changed
dramatically.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about when in the past people were talking about the 87%, that also included the land that was held by the apartheid state. Because the apartheid state held that land in the main for white people. Right. Now, what are the percentages? The percentages have shifted a bit. So we are talking about perhaps some, the state holds quite a bit of land, substantial percentages of land and parcels of land. The problem, okay, firstly, let's just deal with the statistics.
Yeah.
So it's no longer 13 versus 87%. It's now between 20-something%. So it's really not that big, right? The second thing is that if we break down that further, we find that in terms of the land that is used by farmers, okay, in terms of the land that is in private hands, you know, those vast tracts of land that are in private hands, it's huge proportion in relation to the percentage of the population. For example, you have maybe about 30,000, if that much, of commercial farmers in South Africa at the moment, right? But the kind of percentage of land that they use is huge, it's vast. When you drive past yeah. it. It seems like, you know, this is too much. Right?
A guy owns a mountain. How do you own a mountain? I've always found that fascinating. A whole mountain yeah. in your property.
You know, well, these are some of the issues that I think we need to talk about. So the thing is, in terms of, the other complication is that the Department of Rural Development has been trying to look at who owns each and every square meter of land in South Africa.
Right.
And they've not finalized that study, but I understand that it is advanced, because I think that once you have that, then you have a better understanding of what land is there. For example, somewhere in Limpopo, I remember driving and just seeing this huge, acres and acres of land. Mm. And then, it was fenced and it was not used. So I asked, whose land is this? And they said, it's Warren Buffett's land.
Oh, wow.
So there also is a lot of speculative markets by international and local people who are buying land and of course, keeping it and so on. So I think that the conversation on redistribution, therefore, has got to be a much more nuanced conversation than we have now. But I do think it's a very difficult issue.
Nombonizo, most of the people listening to the show don't own even a single hectare of farmland, but tend to jump into the conversation on land, also feeling very emotive about it. So this is a conversation that's being had by a lot of people who have no stake, in inverted commas, in this particular conversation. To what extent is urban land, maybe they feel that their houses are also at stake. To what extent is urban land part of this conversation?
Well, it should be part of a conversation. And, for example, the kind of conversation that I am suggesting that we should have in South Africa, and I think a lot of your listeners are not going to like this, is in fact whether anybody should own land in the first place, whether it's rural, whether it's urban, irrespective, so even for me, the notion of expropriation of land, you are expropriating it from somebody and you're giving it to somebody
else.
So for me, I think we need to have very, very calm conversation about this. So what am I suggesting? I'm suggesting firstly that we look at models in various parts of the world. We look at how they deal with some of these issues. For example, if you live in Sweden and you have, they have the forest cottages or the sea cottages and whatever, you cannot prevent people the right of way.
Okay.
Right? Mm. So you can't own a mountain, actually.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It can't belong to you.
Yes.
So people who have always gone hunting and walked in that forest, so you're
they
having
continue,
that cottage,
yeah.
continue to have that. So that's right of access. It's very contested in law because when you claim that right of access, somebody else feels insecure about it. You've got parts of England where you can't buy land at all. It's considered Queensland. So you can have 99 year lease,
yes.
and it's okay, and you are secure. The generations that come, you can have a whole range of regime that ensures that when you pass on, your children will not be deprived of that property, that there will be a system that can ensure that they will live there. You have countries like Mozambique where also, it's state land. Nobody owns land in Mozambique. You get, including in Maputo, right? Including that
in
house, including that house where Nelson Mandela has, Mrs. Mandela has a house.
Right, yeah.
So they own the house, but they don't own the land. And there's merit to that because it looks at the conversation around land differently. Now the problem is that in a number of countries where the system operates, there's also patronage. There's also corruption that comes in. There are all these kinds of things. So if you were to take the Mozambican example, for example, for argument's sake, you would have to say, okay, how about looking at that model, but then looking at it from a South African perspective and coming up with a kind of regulatory and statutory framework that would take care of some of these problems. So, I live in Johannesburg, right? I believe that The house belongs to me. Mm. The trees I planted. Mm. But actually the idea that I own a piece of ground, you know, is bizarre.
Mm.
You know, land, it depends how you look at land. If we start thinking about land in the way that we think about the sea,
yes,
you know, you may have territorial boundaries in the sea, but you can't actually own the sea.
The sea, yes.
If we look at the sky, mm. I mean, with the drones now and all that, there are all sorts of, you know, obviously law has to develop and people have got to think about, you know, above your, so many meters above your house, mm. is it invasion? Mm. But it's the conversation is about invasion,
yes.
Right? It's not about, you know, so many meters above your house, you own it.
Yes.
So if we think about land in that kind of way, especially in the context of climate change, in the context of growing populations, in the context of a serious land a deficit that we are going to be facing in this country,
mm.
I think we might be able to have some conversation that takes us somewhere.
How do we then deal with, because you cite international examples, but we certainly have those examples in South Africa, the former homelands and so on. In the Eastern Cape, for example, you've got large swaths of land that are occupied using the PTO, permission to occupy, mm-hmm. framework and so on, and you've done a lot of work around the rural, mm-hmm. areas and, mm-hmm. so on, and that doesn't seem to have invigorated the economies in those areas. So when a person then, and the argument tends to be that, well, you don't have title, you can't collateralize, and because you can't collateralize, it's very difficult to get the capital required to work that land. How would you then deal with that argument? Is that even a valid argument to say
this is not an important
part of the balance sheet that allows you to actually make that land productive?
No, actually it's not. Mm. I think that, and we've had conversations with key financial institutions around this. You can't collateralize something that is that doesn't have value,
uh-huh.
right? Mm. So even if I were to have a title deed instead of PTO, the extent to which a bank is going to give me money in relation to that is actually very limited, because they're not going to do it. There's nothing to that they will attach to.
Mm.
So there's the different kind of conversation there in terms of how do you build a different kind of asset base. My argument is that actually don't have different landholding regimes for the country. Have everybody having a single regime for the country. And then you start to ask the market, the financiers, what are the critical issues that you would need to see in place in order to invest in these places?
Mm.
And a lot of it is stability. You know, and that's what the market says, basically, that they want stability. They want to know that if they invest or they lend you money to invest here, that, you know, that there isn't going to be a local government councillor and a ward councillor having a fight with the chief and so on.
Mm.
So that kind of stability. But there are other ways of thinking about it as well. You know, when you buy a house in urban areas, you have to take insurance against that. So there are different ways in which you can collateralize even that property in rural areas.
No, Moniso, I'm interested in what you're saying about this whole idea of no ownership of land. You've just joined the conversation. We're speaking to Nomoniso Gasa, and we're asking, frankly speaking, how do we unlock the land gridlock in SA? Got an old friend of the show coming on just now. He's voting from New York, so we'll find out what he has to say as well. But according to Ruth Hall, who's the Associate Professor at the Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian, mm-hmm. Studies, mm-hmm. I'm sure you know her well,
mm-hmm.
she talks about the fact that Minister Nkwinti is...
Nkwinti.
Mm-hmm. Nkwinti. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get this right. Nkwinti. Since 2013, has done this thing called, or issued a State Land Lease and Deposit Act. Disposal Act, which is effectively saying that the government is buying land at 6% a year. And tell me if you know differently. But not then giving it back to, for example, in this case, black farmers, but getting them to lease the land for the 50 years, and then only are they allowed to buy that land. This is kind of what you're saying, isn't it? Is this right? Is Ruth right on this issue? Is there complexities in this? Or?
Well, Ruth is right on that. But I think it is complex because firstly the key issue is the transfer rate, the extent to which, you know, government can transfer land to people. It's very slow. That's the one cause of backlog.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily the issue. The issue is not about insufficient land. It is about the pace of transfer. That's one. Secondly, the buying of land by government is not going to be sustainable in the long run.
Mm.
And Ruth argues this as well, and many other people elsewhere. It's not going to be sustainable in the long run. It's very expensive purchases.
Yes.
And also it still reproduces the same thing where some people have big portions of land and other people don't have land at all.
Mm.
The third issue is, of course, government has spent a lot of money on recapitalization. So that is capitalizing farmers. You know, so you get the farm, you get subsidy from government and so on, and it's very expensive. But all these issues for me are secondary issues. For me, the issue that needs to be sorted out at a fundamental level is to whom does the land belong, and once you have that conversation about to whom does the land belong. And when I say the land, I mean all land, right? You know, waterfront is owned by the state, right? Mm. And it's leased. That land is leased to 99-year lease. It doesn't prevent development at all. It doesn't slow development. In fact, there's fast-paced development.
Mm.
And so if we can also kind of shift our imagination a little bit. And think of land, you know, as something that doesn't belong to individuals, as something that we need to share. So all these other programs about whether government is giving quickly, at what pace, whether people are buying and so on, for me, these are secondary issues. The fundamental issue is if we are really going to have a redistributive agenda that is not going to fall flat in its face, we've got to think about what is land.
Rory, I want to pick up on something you're saying, but let's get our next guest in here. He is in New York at the moment. It is Ernst Ruert from AfriForum. Ernst, good morning to you. Yes, it's very early morning to you, isn't it? Ernst?
Not at all.
Okay, we'll try bring in Ernst because he's got some interesting comments to say about this, I'm sure.
I think what I want to pick up on is this complexity and how we unwind it. So we do have areas in which people don't own land, and you've given a great example of the V&A waterfront, that's state-owned land. People don't own land, but they occupy the land, and those areas just seem to not being developed. How do we move to a point where we begin to pilot what you're speaking about in those areas? So that requires the financial institutions and so on to reframe their thinking about what they consider an asset and so on. They're not doing it, but we certainly have the land to begin to experiment with it. What is it going to take, and what would need to be true for financial institutions to say, okay, I mean, that's a valid point. In this area where we can pilot it, let's pilot it and see what happens.
I think you can have, I mean, look, currently there is a conversation that government is having on communal land tenure, right? So what kind of tenure system will be in rural areas, right? Already, if you were to look at that, there is a potential there to address some of these niggly issues about, you know, does this homestead belong to me? Mm. Does it belong to the community? But most importantly, if people want to come up with a trust or any other business model, they can do that, and then they can lend, they can borrow money from banks, and then you can have those kinds of arrangements.
Mm.
I think part of that is that there isn't clear legislation at the moment that addresses those areas. And there is legislation that is in the pipeline, but I think that legislation is going to need quite a lot of work
to get it
right. But still, it's not going to address the fundamental issues around ownership. You also look at places like urban areas, peri-urban areas like RDP houses, for example, right, where people don't have title deeds, whereas people who live next to them in the suburb have title deeds. So all these kinds of different inequalities about land holding create, I think, ongoing perception that there's nothing that is happening around land.
We have a similar situation, I think, in Alex, not too far from here, right? So that large portions of that, the people still don't own it. And the question is then, how do they move forward? How do we deal with the fact that this is such an emotive conversation? Because one might argue that we are having a very theoretical conversation. The land thing does not happen in a vacuum. It happens within the context of the economics of the country, the history of the country, the emotions of the country. What is it going to take? Because and we can't use the easy answer leadership, because we certainly don't seem to have any. So what is it going to take to get us all around the table and to remove all of these things, say, for the sake of us moving forward? Otherwise, we're going to be having this conversation in 50 years' time.
Well, we're sitting here now, you're right, and somebody from AfriForum, I hope, is going to be online, and we're having this conversation. I think that's the first thing. I think we need to break this down. The fundamental question is, what is land proxy for? What is it made to be proxy for? So land is about power. Land is about wealth. Land is about history. Land is about identity, right? And what is it proxy for? It's proxy for those things as well. And sometimes at certain points, politicians also tap into it to use it in order to get, as popular as a tool and all of that. So I think if we break it down to say, what does land mean to you? Right. What does not having land mean to you? But what does having land actually mean? You know, it means security. Right. So can you have security without necessarily owning that land? Yes, you can. Right.
So isn't that a big leap that we're asking people to do? So, for example, let's say I own a property here in Sandton. You're then suggesting that I will no longer own that property tomorrow. At the stroke of midnight, it's no longer my land. That's not something that I must just accept. It means the financial institution must accept that my balance sheet hasn't changed. It's just the fact that I don't own it anymore. We need an entire systemic change all at the same time. Is that even so? Are we going to be criticized and say that, guys, this is theoretical, pie in the sky, it will never happen? No,
well, listen, 20 years we're here, okay? We do need a leap of imagination, right? We have serious crisis of imagination in this country. I think we can think boldly. Of course, I'm not suggesting that tomorrow somebody comes and says, oh, you no longer own this. So we can actually have conversations and think about how you move from one system to another.
To the next, yes.
And what components do you need for that?
Let me challenge that. So yes, we get this leap of imagination. What's the next step after that? What's the leap of action that would support the leap of imagination?
Firstly, you need to have this conversation.
Yes.
You need to have the difficult questions. You need to say, okay, what is this model nomonster that you're talking about? What are your thought processes around this? What are the economics of it? What are the inheritance issues around it? What are the racial questions around it? What are the colonial legacy issues around it? And then somebody else comes in and says, "Oh well, you know, I'm a Boer, and the way we got
I like
this accent.
I like that accent.
That sounds like a jock who just went through to
become
a Boer. I did some gym, and now I'm cutting some sheep.
It's just like such a stereotype. But I had an I imagine some people that I speak to, this land we've worked, but most importantly, for them, for that person, it's also emotional, because
yes,
it takes them to the Anglo-Boer War.
Yes.
Right? So you need to be able to listen to that and listen to the fact that for that particular person, right,
it is,
the land is what they got, that they had remaining after the Anglo-Boer War.
Yes.
Right? So you then also need to understand somebody of Jewish descent, of Jewish descent is going to come and say, you know, there's a history around people of Jewish descent. That actually goes way before, you know, Hitler.
Yes.
And dispossession of land and not allowed to, to own land in Europe and so on. So for me, this, if you're saying this touches on that.
Yes.
So we also have to kind of listen.
Yes.
Right? And then there's going to be the koi.
I wanted to touch on that, yes.
You know the Nando's advert, you know,
yes,
so I say, yeah,
yes.
Oh, you know.
Where are you from?
But actually, all of you get out of it, out of here.
Yes.
So I think we need to have a conversation that is that looks at all the nuances and all the baggage that we carry.
Just quickly, I want to just interject very quickly. I'm interested because it seems like that then equalizes one lever, which I'm actually open to. I think it's quite interesting as a concept. My imagination, I'm trying to be good here on Wednesdays, you know. But isn't land a symbol for redistribution of wealth, which is the bigger issue, you know, and a lot of populist discussions around we need the land so that we can build the wealth, right? And Rory was alluding to it a little bit with regards to trying to build wealth through financing and stuff like that. But it's more of an emotional thing.
It is an emotional thing.
I need land so I can create wealth. Now, if you equalize us by saying, right, no one has land now, it's all owned by the state, how do we then still challenge that idea of saying, well, if you were in the Free State and you were living on a plot of land that wasn't owned by you, it was owned by a farmer, for example, so the typical case, let's use
case thing,
and then we say, right, no land anymore, right, so everyone doesn't have land, how does it change that person's perspective who's now sitting in this rural Free State area, still without wealth, still now without land, but no one else has land?
Well, firstly, it's not no one else has land. Everybody has land because the land is in the hands of the state. Okay? And then we have to sort out security around that. We have to sort out access around that. We have to sort out patronage and all those kinds of things. But then you're asking a very important question. Say, okay, actually it doesn't really matter, you know, whether I own land or not.
Yeah.
The thing is that the inequality is still going to remain.
Yeah.
Right? Some people are going to have bigger pieces of land and others may not. Even with the lease system, that's still going to happen, right? So what then you also need to do is to have what Rorisang was talking about, which is a conversation around a paradigm.
Mm.
You know, how do we finance? You know, how do we get access? How do we ensure that, you know, some people are not using more than other people, right? And we are going to have this conversation whether we like it or not, right? We are going to have, I mean, the Minister of Rural Development is already talking about a ceiling in terms of the pieces of, I mean, how many acres of land can one person own. So we are going to have this conversation. We are already having conversations about how much water can one family have. So part of that then is going to be about, okay, so this is the land that you are in. What are your requirements? What are the requirements for this? Because part of the problem is, you know, there are urban legends about how, you know, the farms that were given to black people are lying fallow. People are not working those land, those farms, or they've neglected them, they've stripped them, they've done this, that, and the other.
Mm.
Now, that may be 0.05% of those farms. A lot of them, actually, are not coming off the ground because of financial support, because of a whole range of things that they need.
Yeah.
And so, when you look at Afrikaner farmers, let's say, let me just use that term. The apartheid state actually helped them a lot in terms of farming. Absa's origin, you know, as a bank, was an institution that was lending money. It has that agricultural background, so they could have access to credit on good terms. So if you're a farmer, if you're a black commercial farmer at the moment, right? And I'm talking about the ones who have gone into the open market. I'm not even talking about the ones that have been given land by the state. You don't have that kind of support, right? Everything is at commercial value. It's at premium market value. Mm. And already people are indebted. Farming is expensive.
And risky. Right?
It's very, very risky. Mm. And so when people say, I want land to create wealth, we also need to understand that land doesn't necessarily create wealth. Mm. You know, so other people, you also have developers coming into the mix. Mm. So everybody, I would like to own a huge piece in Hyde Park or Sandhurst and build townhouses and all these kinds of things.
You and me both. Eh?
You know, but you know what? It might work. But it might also get depressed at some point. So you need to come up with statutory and laws. Mm. Once you have this conversation, you need to say that we also need to have a conversation about you can't have two-thirds of the plate other people don't have. And how do we do that? And it is going to be an emotive conversation, but I think that it is also going to be necessary for those emotions to come out and also for us to actually have a proper vision in terms of how we look at land.
Mm. All right, let's try bringing Adam now. We've been having a few complications, but hopefully we've sorted it out. He's in New York, so it's pretty early there. Adam, good morning to you.
I'm here, yes.
Hey, there you are.
That's 3:45 in the morning.
Is that time lapse? You see,
are you doing well?
We're good. Thank you, Adam. So we've got Nombonizo Gasa in here. We're speaking about the land. Frankly speaking, how do we unlock the land gridlock in SA? Nombonizo is suggesting that we have no ownership of land. Give us your thoughts on that.
I mean, that's just ridiculous. That's what Joseph Stalin suggested, and that's what Mao Zedong suggested. So those were the people who were the fastest in this, were people who said we should have no ownership of land. I mean, there's nowhere in the entire world. That's also what's happening in North Korea. And that's to a degree what's happening in Zimbabwe, where they've just taken all the land and sort of vested it in the government. So it might sound like a wonderful idea, but there's no country in the world where having ownership of land into wealth or into creating a better future for people. That's just crazy. If you don't have private property, no one's going to want to farm and produce on a piece of land that is not their property, because
Let's maybe test that. So you are making a causal link, or you're creating a causal link between the fact that you own land and your willingness to farm it and your ability to then make money off it, right? What is it that makes you, because you're making a huge statement that nobody would want to do this and that it's never worked and so on, but those are huge statements, and I wonder to what extent they are factually true. What is it about not owning land that then creates that sort of setup? And because yes, you can approach it emotionally and so on, but if we just look at it for what it is, what is it, if everybody stopped owning land, what would cause that to cause a gridlock, or at least a pause in our ability to have this land being an economically productive asset for the country as a whole?
Ernst
has given up on me.
I think he's Skype.
So Ernst says he's not even saying it, he doesn't agree. He says it's ridiculous. It's crazy. Have we just spent a whole 50 minutes entertaining your craziness here?
Why have we done that?
Because now this is really embarrassing. 50 minutes listening to a crazy person sharing crazy ideas. How do you respond to this? Ernst says this is crazy.
Well, actually, I am crazy, you know. Well, I'm crazy, but I'm crazy in a different way. Firstly, it's not true that it has never worked anywhere in the world. I don't think that statement is based on fact. Fact actually shows pockets of land in England that are doing quite fine, that fall under that are called the Queen's Land. Also, I have made an example of the waterfront, right? I can give you examples of farmers in Europe who actually don't own the farm, but actually work and work productively on those huge farms.
But that's the thing, right? You sell the crop. It's not as if you sell the land,
and,
right?
And they use huge machines. I mean, those like monster machines that like cost millions, right? And they lease the land. Okay, so I think Aaron's is making I understand what I understand the alarm bells, right? Because the alarm bells are about expropriation and nationalization, right? And that this is Stalinism, this is you know what Mao Zedong did, and so on. But actually, even the Chinese model, right, with its problems, right, is not completely failing, right? China is one of the fastest growing economies in the world, right? So I think we need to be very careful about just being very dismissive. Mozambique, he says nowhere in the world, Mozambique, nobody owns the land. Malawi, nobody owns the land, right? There are problems in terms of how that is managed in some countries, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's totally impossible.
What? So I just this we spoke about this crisis of imagination, which I really, really agree with. But when you have that sort of a response, right? So let's not look at it as just a reactive response. Let's look at it as a legitimate response from an individual who feels certain things and believes them to be true. What is going on in the mind of an Ernst? So you said it's alarm bells and so on, and that is why he's responding that way.
Well, I don't know him.
Yes, but I mean, whatever he represents. So if he's an archetype of a person who's responding to this issue in that way, what's going on that is so felt at such a deep level?
A lot of people, it's fear. A lot of people, it's you're going to take my land and I'm going to... I mean, he's making an example. He's making a link, for example, Zimbabwe. Mm. What I'm suggesting is completely different from Zimbabwe. Mm. But there is fear. There's fear. You know, whenever you're going to have an idea that is unusual, people are going to be afraid. Right, so there's fear, there's anxiety, there's a sense of loss, you know, that I might lose land, I might lose power, right, I might lose status in society. So it's not just about, and lots of people are going to have that kind of reaction. A lot of people who are saying expropriate without compensation or with minimum compensation and so on are going to say to me that, sorry, when are we going to end up with nothing? You know, so there's a real historical stuff here that informs how people respond.
We've got Ernst back on the line. Ernst, are you there?
Yes.
Ernst, I think help us. We don't have a lot of time, but we're trying to understand your reaction. So there is perhaps a bigger imperative that we as a country move forward and that we find solutions that are sustainable. And what you're essentially suggesting is that it is better that that few people own some pieces of land versus all of us not having but having the right to work the land in different ways in order to be productive and to make money of it. Why is this such a difficult thing for you to accept? Why can't we all just, you know, the land is owned by the state and we all work it through leases and so on, rather than the current situation where some have and some don't, and that creates tensions that continue to reflect our colonial and apartheid past?
Well, the point is that we need to have a system or a policy that is economically viable. China, for example, I mentioned China. The reason why China currently has economic growth is because they have been shifting away from this communist approach, where they have created what they call special economic zones, where government is not intervening, where people have private property, and people can use that private property to produce. And as a result of these private or special economic zones, that's what's boosted the economy.
Is part of that property the land in those areas?
Where people have private ownership, yes.
Okay.
So the point is, I mean, it sounds great. Wow, the state must own everything and people must then work on the state's land. But there's no country in the world where that has worked. So,
why hasn't it worked, Ernst?
because the point that I was making earlier when I was when the line dropped was the basic economic principle is called incentive. So you need to have an incentive to really produce something with what you have. But if there's a piece of land, it's owned by government. Government says to you, yeah, we're doing you this favor. You can live on this piece of land. You can start a cattle farm. But you know that at any moment, government can come to you and say, listen, we've went back, we've decided what the situation is, and we thought, you know what, we're going to take back that piece of land. It's not yours in the first place in any case. You wouldn't, no person with a sane mind would want to really invest on that piece of land, knowing that it's not theirs. There's a high risk of them, of that land being taken away, well, not being taken away from them because it wasn't theirs in the first place, of them being, government deciding that, you know what, something else needs to be done with that land. So there's no security in that piece of land.
But that assumes that you don't have a legislative framework around how long you're leasing that land for and so on. It's. I mean, if we say you've got a 100-year lease, it's a 100-year lease and no one is coming to take it from you before that.
Well, it's not working in Zimbabwe. I mean, Zimbabwe has hyperinflation. They have more than 1,000% inflation.
Mm.
The point is, there's an immediate...
Let's get Nombonisa.
It's a pity you...
Well, if you don't have private property, we don't have a democracy in South Africa as well. If you don't have a right to own private property...
Adams, let's get Nombonisa to respond to that quick.
Well, firstly, it's a pity you've joined us late, Adams, because actually... the point that I'm making is very, very different. And the special economic zones that you're talking about in China are not new, Shenzhen and those places. And they are not owned by people, actually. I think it's very important to understand the Chinese model very, very closely. The kind of system that they are introducing is similar to what you would have anywhere else where you have 100-year lease, where you have the security for that. You say that nowhere in the world do these things work. Actually, that is also not true. There are parts in Britain, for example, where you don't own Queensland, but you live there and you can develop that property. I think what the conversation really should be about is what would changing the ownership structure address the fundamental questions of access to land. Would it make people secure? Is it possible for people's rights not to be trampled on? And I think it's very important for us to be careful when we talk about private property. And remember the South African Constitution in the property clause, it doesn't say you have a right to private property. It says you cannot be arbitrarily deprived of property. So the notion of private property is not the holy grail. For a long time. And again, one day we also need to talk about Zimbabwe and talk about the 20 plus years before ZANU-PF turned on the white farmers. And part of it, in fact, was about the relationship, the cozy relationship that the white farmers had in Zimbabwe with the ZANU-PF government. And when they felt the populist pressure, then the government turned on them. So there was private property there. It didn't work for most people. There still is private property.
Yes,
it's destroyed
the economy.
Guys, unfortunately, we have run out of time. Ernst, please get back. We don't know what you're doing in New York. You're very secretive about what you're doing in New York. You're just posting pictures of movies and so on. But this is a conversation. He's not on holiday. So this is a conversation that we all definitely need to have. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. But Andrew, where are we on this? Are you giving me your lovely house in beautiful San Antonio?
Well, okay, so I just want to say before we end up, I think what we need to do is have Nombonisa in again, we have Adams, and maybe we try to get Andile as well, and have a brainstorm about what we can do, because clearly it's not working. Whatever's happening is not working. And I think Nombonisa's right. We've got a problem of imagination here, and it would be very interesting to have these three characters who sit on very different sides of the fence come together and say, what could we do in order to make this work?
Well, part of that is to agree what happened in the past. I think now we're getting to a point where we agree on the facts. We don't agree on how it felt for all of us. Some believe colonialism was to be celebrated. Some believe it was painful.
Now, why are you going about Helen's tweets?
I'm tired.
Listen, I think the other thing which is interesting is that we are, as a world, we're moving to this idea of non-ownership. If you think of models like Airbnb, if you think of models like Uber,
information technology.
Is something in this theory.
Open access.
Absolutely. So let's have this conversation again. It's certainly one worth having. And I think that one of the most important things that was said here is we do have a crisis of imagination, not just about land, about a number of different things, governance and so on. And we do need to start having the conversation of how do we unlock the gridlock.
Yeah. Nombonisa, as per usual, thank you so much for your wise words. We love having you here. Please do come again to have this conversation with Ernst in studio. Thank you, Ernst Roots. And apologies to Annalise for us getting cut off. We had some technical issues. But thank you so much for listening. And yes, we will do this again next week. I think we should also say, you know, rest in peace to Uncle Kathy.
Yes.
He's being put to rest in his final resting place today. Uncle Kathy, go well. We thank you for all your amazing, amazing dedication to this country. And we wish you and your family all the best.
Rest in power, old man.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day. Ciao, ciao.
Bye. CliffCentral.com.